And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
It all happens so fast. You're out with your friends on a weekend retreat. It's a beautiful afternoon. Spring flowers are beginning to shoot up in the forest. You've got your new field guide, and it's a perfect opportunity to identify a few new flowers. You wander off with your book in hand, sit down with some new species, and then you notice clouds moving in. It's getting colder. You didn't bring a jacket, so you pick up your book and head back. After an hour, you realize you're lost. Today, it's a lesson in survival. When your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
It happens every year. The story of a young hiker who wanders away from a family get-together in a park, and then the terrible feeling that something's gone wrong. The hiker has been gone far too long. There just may be no worse feeling than to sense that someone you love and care about has gone missing. When it happens on a trip to the backcountry, the fears multiply. And to a large extent, the attempts to locate the lost hiker increase in rugged and varied terrain. So many things can go wrong. This past week, we've been following the story of a 12-year-old scout who was lost for 4 days in the mountains of North Carolina. Quickly, National Park Rangers mounted a search and were assisted by various professional and volunteer search and rescue teams, including the canine trackers. Finally, Gandalf, a 2-year-old retriever on his first search and rescue mission, bobbed his head 3 times, and across the river, there was 12-year-old Michael Aubrey, dehydrated and hungry, but otherwise all right. Today we bring you wise counsel on what you need to know if you should ever find yourself lost. It's a lesson in survival, and we dedicate segments 2 and 3 to this very important topic. Following today's news, we've been hearing for many months about the glass walkway that was being constructed in the Grand Canyon. And after 4 years of work, it opened this week. You're going to get an aerial view of the new Skywalk adventure as we travel to the Hualapai Nation and talk with Sherry Yellowhawk, who took the first steps into the wonder 4,000 feet above the canyon floor. It's a great show coming up. So let's get right into today's news. So now, the news. Al Gore was back in Washington bringing the inconvenient truth about global warming to both the House and the Senate. He laid out the challenge to the leadership.
A time will come when a future generation will look back on 2007 at this hopeful time, and they will ask one of two questions. Either they will ask, what in God's name were they doing? Didn't they see the evidence? Didn't they hear the warnings? Didn't they see the mountain glaciers melting in every part of this earth? Didn't they see the North Polar ice cap melting? Didn't they hear the scientists say it may be gone in as little as 34 years? Didn't they hear the seismographers telling them that the earth is shaking because of the glacial earthquakes on Greenland? 32 of them this year. Up to 5.1 on the Richter scale. Didn't they see the evidence of nature being on the run?
Some of his old adversaries made it clear why they can't seem to hear Al Gore's message.
I've structured my questions so they're yes or no questions, and they don't require a lot of elaboration. So let me start off with 4, and these should be pretty easy. I know the answer because I've heard some quotes from you that lead me to believe what the answer is. First of all, yes or no, do you believe that human-caused global warming is a moral, ethical, and spiritual issue affecting our survival?
Yes, I do.
Yes or no, do you believe that reducing fossil fuel-based energy usage will lead to lower greenhouse gas emissions?
It depends on what the substitutes are, but basically, yes. I think we can capture and sequester the carbon and continue using carbon-based
energy. Very good. In yes or no, do you believe that home energy use is a key component, not the only component, but a key component to overall energy use?
I believe that buildings as well as cars and trucks and factories are definitely a part of the problem, yes.
All right. Now, I'd like to put up the little pledge thing here. I'm going to ask you if you would like to commit here today. You know how many hundreds of thousands of fans you have out there that would like to follow your lead. And this pledge merely says, as you can read it up there, that you're agreeing to consume no more energy in your residence than the average American household by 1 year from today. Not right now. You've got a whole year to try to do this. Now, the one thing I'd like to have you not use in response to this question, which is a yes or no question, is the various gimmicks. Now, I have something I want to submit for the record, Madam Chairman, that talks about the effects, the offsets and the credits are gimmicks used by the wealthy so they don't have to change their lifestyles. And I have an article that is last Sunday's United Kingdom Times. I'd like to submit for the record at this time.
You may.
All right. What's your answer?
Well, first of all, Senator, thank you so much for your question.
All right. I noticed Tipper didn't say thank you for the question.
Oh, I'm sure she would. But
you're welcome.
Yeah. You know, one of the other recommendations that I would have is that you also set standards for green energy produced by utilities. And one reason I say that in response to what you're saying here is that that's what we purchase, and we pay more for it because it's relatively uncommon.
Senator
you've asked the senator an important question. He's answering it. Given
all right, if you could stop the clock during this time.
No, I'm not going to stop the clock. He has a minute to answer. How can you ask a question and not give a man a minute to answer? Please.
Yeah, we purchase wind energy and other green energy that does not produce carbon dioxide. And that does cost a little more now, and that is one of the reasons why it costs a little more. We're also in the process of renovating an old home. And we live not far from where Lamar and Honey Alexander do. And we,
Senator Gore, you had so much more time. I'm going to have to.
Could I make one other point? Because a lot of communities actually have laws preventing the installation of solar photovoltaic.
So I assume the answer is no. Let's go to the next question.
And if I could continue, I believe that there should be a federal provision that overrides any local restrictions.
All right, Senator Gore, I'm very sorry. I don't want to be rude, but from now on, I'm going to ask you to respond for the record in writing, since you're not going to respond.
Well, if I choose to respond to you verbally here, I hope that'll be okay, too.
If it's a very brief response. All right. I'm sure you read the New York Times article that quoted the scientist. I mentioned this in my opening statement about they're criticizing you for some of your being too alarmist and hurting your own cause. Now, I'll ask you to respond in writing for that one, because that would be a very long response, I'm afraid. Now, it seems that global warming and the media joined the chorus last summer.
Excuse me, Senator Knopf, we'll freeze the time for a minute.
Oh, yes.
I'm just trying to make...
Take your time. We're freezing the time.
We're freezing the time. Just for a minute. I want to talk to you a minute, please. Would you agree to let the Vice President answer your questions? And then if you want an extra few minutes at the end, I'm happy to give it to you. But we're not going to get anywhere.
Why don't we do this?
You're asking
Why don't we
questions?
Do this? At the end, you can have as much time as you want to answer all the questions.
No, that isn't the rule. You're not making the rules. You used to when you did this. You don't do this anymore. Elections have consequences. Elections have consequences, so I make the rules. But here's the thing. I want you to get your questions answered.
Gore outlined steps he feels can lead to eventually addressing the challenges ahead.
I want to talk to you a little bit about some ideas that I believe could help hopefully help in your deliberations. First of all, I think that we ought to have an immediate freeze on CO2 emissions and start the reductions from there. Secondly, I think that we ought to use the tax code not to increase taxes, Senator Inhofe. I'm not for that. I think we ought to cut taxes on employment and take that burden off employees and employers and make up the difference with pollution taxes, principally CO2 taxes. Third, I believe that we ought to have a moratorium on any new coal plants that are not fixed with carbon capture and sequestration technology. It is simply irresponsible to go forward without carbon capture and sequestration. Fifth, I believe that this Congress, this Senate, should fix a date in the future beyond which incandescent light bulbs are banned. Sixth, we ought to have an electronet, and we ought to encourage widely distributed power generation by homeowners, by small business owners, and here's the key. You ought to take off the cap, let them sell as much as they want to into the grid. Then I think we ought to raise the CAFE standards for auto efficiency. I do think it ought to be part of a comprehensive solution. Don't single out autos as the main culprit. It is part of it, and it's a significant part of it. Next, I would propose that you pass a carbon neutral mortgage association, or Connie Mae, and here's why. Expenditures that go into more insulation and window treatments and the expenditures that don't pay back immediately, but they pay back over 2 or 3 years in lower energy bills, they're not used because they raise the purchase price. Put those in a separate instrument and have a Connie Mae that bundles those and sells them in the marketplace. Then when you go to a closing, you sign your mortgage and the banker and the seller say, now here's your Connie Mae here. This is going to lower your electricity bills. You're going to save, reduce CO2 at the same time. This is my last recommendation. Require corporate disclosure of carbon emissions. Investors have a right to know about material risks that could affect the future value of the stocks that they purchase. I want to close by reemphasizing my belief that it is also the greatest opportunity we've ever confronted. We can become more efficient and more productive. We can create more jobs and lift our standards of living. And in the process, we can save the habitability of this planet and tell that future generation that we were up to the challenge and we did what some thought was impossible. We did it on a bipartisan basis. And in the process, we gained the vision and moral authority in our generation to take on these other challenges that also need our attention. Thank you.
Vice President Gore was clear that he felt an immediate freeze on CO2 emissions, coupled with a nationwide cap and trade program, would communicate a solid commitment by the nation's leaders to address these problems. This past winter was the warmest on record worldwide, according to a report released by the U.S. government on changing climate. The report follows on an earlier study by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that stated that the warming conditions are almost certainly a result of the effects of a modernizing world. Translated, the report stated that the rate of increase in temperatures has tripled in the last 40 years. Without fanfare, the Department of the Interior reinterpreted protections and practices relating to endangered species, which stated that only species of plants and animals which are struggling for survival will be provided protections, while no actions or protections will be provided for healthy populations or where they have already disappeared. Numerous conservation groups responded that the reinterpretation could result in 80% of current species identified as endangered being declassified because they no longer exist in a particular area or are not currently underpopulated. This would take the teeth out of legal protections offered to animals who may be threatened and remove legal mandates to restore various animal and plant species that have already been decimated. The critical feature, which has been tested by the courts in suits involving government lawyers, tries to establish the precedent that a species cannot be listed based on its disappearance in a portion of its range unless that disappearance would directly result in threatening its continued survival everywhere. This issue will continue to find its way into court cases with greater frequency. And with all the attention now focused on the plight of the polar bear due to climate change, in Berlin, Germany, a national tug-of-war with two sides wanting to determine the future of a 19-pound polar bear cub is tearing that country apart. Knut, one of two cubs abandoned by its mother at the Berlin Zoo, managed to survive with human intervention to care and feed the little cub following the death of his little bear brother as a result of the mother's abandonment of the cubs. Animal rights activists demanded that if the mother abandoned the cub, it is immoral and unnatural for the bear to be saved by humans, and therefore it should be killed. Needless to say, this was not received well by most of the German public, and certainly not by the zoo officials who have adopted the little white bear cub, sleeping with him and feeding him. It has become yet another media circus, and perhaps the best we can say is that we've learned from this skirmish that the problems of the sensationalist press are not limited to the American media. The effects of globalization now are being felt, as would be expected, around the world. And that's the news. And a few reminders. For the past few weeks, I've been hinting that something's coming, and now it's time to give you the first inkling of what that is. I'm thrilled to announce that in the months ahead, the Wildside News will be providing a weekly Earth Summit, bringing together some of the world's leading voices in a brief, to-the-point weekly briefing on events that are shaping our world. That's all I'm going to say right now, but next week, I'll tell you more. And a reminder that next week, we talk with Mark Beckoff as he talks about the emotional lives of animals. Be sure to tune in. And now it's time to head on out to the Hualapai Nation for a special report on the new skywalk that has been making the news. There's a lot of news these days coming out of the Grand Canyon about an amazing opportunity for people to experience the Grand Canyon like they've never experienced it before. And this is something that we're seeing. It's just launched, as a matter of fact, in the last couple of days, which is something called Skywalk. And to help us really get an appreciation of exactly what Skywalk is, we're now joined by Sherry Yellowhawk, who is the CEO of the Grand Canyon Resort Corporation. Sherry, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you.
Well, you've been very busy. You've been busy talking about this absolutely new, spectacular opportunity for people to experience the Grand Canyon. Tell us a little bit about Skywalk.
Well, the Skywalk is actually the vision of David Jin. It started off in 1996 when I wasn't a part of the company as a small idea of a 10-foot glass platform over the edge of the canyon, and when I became CEO of the company in 2002, we started talking about it again, and I guess the board had previously approved it, but nobody took off with it, and so it still was that little 10-foot platform. It sort of evolved from there, and now it was a 3-year process because the tribe has its own internal environmental, cultural, and biological, and its own processes, and so we had to go through all those processes and engaging in the terms of the deal with the investor, and it has evolved into what you see today, the horseshoe-shaped platform that is 70 feet out from the canyon wall.
I always try to imagine, because I'm an idea person. I love coming up. I have too many ideas, okay? and trying to take an idea and bring it into reality is the challenge. Ideas are cheap, but bringing it into reality is the hard part. I'm just curious what you can share about how it moves from a 10-foot vision to this extraordinary 70-foot. What was involved in that? How did that happen, particularly when you're dealing with any organization? And in your case, it happens to be the Hualapai tribe. How did that evolve?
Well, it was, first it was this 10-foot platform at, we have a point out there, and it's kind of a funny term. It's because there used to be old guano mines there. It's called Guano Point, and it was originally thought to be there, but we thought, well, it's going to take away from its own panoramic view there, and then we thought, well, let's look at Eagle Point, and Eagle Point is named because of there's a rock formation there that actually looks like a huge eagle with its wings spanned out. And we had a ex-CEO, and I want to mention his name, Cameron Danes, because he really did contribute to this horseshoe-shaped concept of moving the platform type of concept into this horseshoe-shaped concept. And then at that time it was this, it went from 15 feet, and then our CFO and David Jin thought, well, you can only put this many people and you're only going to make this much money in. And then it went from 15 to 30 to 70. And now we're even looking at, well, we could have put it out another 50 feet.
Oh, wow.
So, but it would have took away from the visitor experience if there's too many people out there. So over the years since 2002, which the ball really started rolling in 2003, the idea has evolved in that order.
It's an amazing accomplishment in a five-year period, because it's a massive structure, and the engineering and the architecture alone, typically one would think would take even longer than that to accomplish. For people who somehow have missed this story, tell people exactly what they're going to experience through Skywalk.
Well, there's a whole array of experiences, because on the first tribal walk, which occurred 2 days ago, my first walk, I wasn't afraid of it, because I know the engineering of it. It was way overbuilt, and it will probably still, the steel structure will still be there 1,000 years from now. And my first experience of it was seeing the canyon, the same point that I see almost on a weekly basis, in a whole different perspective. But when I watched the tribal members go out there on the 19th, it was just like being a little kid again, because I watched a whole array of emotions and expressions, and some were scared and some were excited and some were just, you know, wow and awed, and I mean, there's, what I like about it is that there is going to be an individual experience for everyone. It's not just one experience. Everyone is going to have their own experience of the Skywalk. And some people laid on the glass, and some people, clung onto the rail. Some people just walk right down the middle. Some people, looked over the edge and wanted to go all different angles, because it really is a 360-degree view of that point of the canyon, and you can see it in a whole different perspective. Mm-hmm. And so it was just wonderful for me to see a majority of our tribal membership experience that. That was a great day for me.
Well, I know for myself, I mean, for anyone who maybe somehow has missed what is involved in Skywalk, it is a big 70-foot horseshoe-shaped structure that has an absolutely clear glass bottom.
Yes.
Walkway. You walk on glass. So, you know, that just walking on glass itself over any kind of gap would be a bit of a challenge. But when you're 4,000 feet off the ground, that first step has got to be a test of your will and your strength.
Yes, and well, for me, as long as things aren't moving, I'm okay. You put me in a helicopter and an airplane, I don't do too well in there if it's bumpy And but the skywalk, it's not moving. So, well, I shouldn't say that, because the glass can't, it can't be rigid. It
right.
has to move a little bit. It's part of the architecture, it's part of the engineering. It has to move a little bit, otherwise it would crack eventually with all the movement. It's a part of the engineering.
Hmm.
So it gives that almost like cracking sound, so it adds to the effect.
Oh, wow.
And so that doesn't sit easy with a lot of people.
Wow.
And so it actually moves.
It's an enormous structure. There's, what, a million?
A million pounds of steel. And the glass, I can't remember how much it adds to it. It's quite a bit more, the glass itself that adds to it.
There's fully about 8 inches thick of glass. It's a different layers, and I thought it was very clever that the top layer...
Oh, it's not even 8 inches.
Isn't it, really?
It's about 4.5 inches.
Oh, is that right? Yeah, yes. I guess maybe that's right. The top layer is a thinner layer such that that can be replaced because it will get scratched through time. And part of that is apparently when you visit Skywalk, you have to put on special shoes.
Yes, we have little booties.
Little booties.
They're almost like when you... like surgical booties. But they also help you not to slip, because the glass has to be cleaned daily, so you get a better experience. But they help with not to scratch the glass, and also for the visitors not to slip.
Mm-hmm. So you walk out on glass, and therefore you're stepping out almost like you're flying, like a bird, I suppose, and or hovering really above the canyon. And then the walls of the are glass as well. So you
yes.
look out. Mm-hmm.
Yes, on the sides there's 32 inches on each side of that is steel that you could, you know, if you don't want to totally experience just the glass, and there was a lot of people sticking to that side. Well, I wouldn't say a lot. Sticking to the side where you can just stay on the steel.
You mean kind of like the inner loop of the
yeah,
of
the inner and the outer.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's the part of the steel beam that
I
the
see.
Glass sits on.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a few people that would just stay there, but not too many. And I expected more. I really did when I first seen it. I really expected a lot more people to walk on those portions, and I really expected like 70 to 80% of the people to be there. But my God, I just seen people just going straight down the middle, and just like I was, because I, besides the construction workers, I really did take the first walk. And I went straight down the middle. I thought, oh, well, I'm going to go for it.
Yeah, you may as well.
I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it.
Well,
and
it is safe, too. I mean, we need to overemphasize the fact that we're going to have natural fears, just because many people do, you
mm-hmm.
know, stepping out into space. But it is there's no chance this is going to give you any kind of a hard time.
No way.
Yeah, exactly. You know, one of the things that a lot of people, I think, misunderstand, a lot of people through the press think this is in actually Grand Canyon National Park, and it's not.
It's not. It's on the Hualapai Indian Reservation, and it's on the far west side of the Grand Canyon, and it's closer towards Vegas. But if they show up at the south rim at the national park and they're looking for it, hey, we got an airplane ready to take them to the west rim.
Oh, that's exciting. Well, that's fun. Then you get a double bonus. You get
yeah.
a chance to see the Grand Canyon from the air, and then as well, literally out in the middle of the Grand Canyon.
Yes. So if they're going there saying, where's the Skywalk? Well, you can get on this airplane, and we'll take you over there, and you can experience us and bring you on back, because we're quite different from this South Rim. We have more of a pristine setting, and the South Rim is more wide.
Mm-hmm.
Our cliffs are more dramatic and dropped off and just straight down.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just a different the scenery is just very different.
Well, tell everybody what you think would be a great way to experience this. You know, it's about 240 some miles, I believe, from the South Rim. So that's, you know, if you're going to decide to drive, that's a bit of a day's drive. But what's the best way for, what do you think is the best way for people to experience the Skywalk?
I think, it depends on where you're coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Give me an example. Where are you coming
from?
Well,
a lot of people come from Las Vegas, I'm sure.
Okay, but if it depends on, you know, how much money you have and if you're driving.
Okay, let's talk about a family. Let's say a family wants to go out there and they've got two, three kids and a mom and a pop and they want to visit the Skywalk.
And they rented a car?
Okay, that sounds good.
Okay, so they rented a car. I would say that they should get on our website, destinationgrandcanyon.com. And they rent a car, and when they call get the book their package, actually, there's a park and ride, because unfortunately we have 14 miles of a dirt road, which we're taking care of. We're going to start construction on paving that 14 miles this summer, and which isn't our land, but we're paying for it, our land meaning Hualapai land. And but we have a park and ride so that rental car companies don't have to worry about their cars getting beat up. And that family can get on that park and ride bus, which will take them to Grand Canyon West. They will check in at the terminal, and they will purchase a Spirit package and Skywalk package, which is the Spirit is $49.95. And the Skywalk is $25. And that may sound like a lot, but it's not like the $25 that per car going to the South Rim and you stand at the canyon and their survey shows that the average visitor only looks at the canyon for 15 minutes. They have an actual survey that shows this. With our package, you get going to Guano Point, which shows the remnants of the old guano mine, which operated in the 1950s, and you can actually see the old tramway remnants, and you see the river, and there's a small hike there that is spectacular, and you can actually, you have your meal there, which is included in the package, and you don't get that at the South Rim. And you eat on the rim of the canyon. And we have our Hualapai members selling various arts and crafts there. So that's just one point. And then you go to Eagle Point, where the Skywalk is, and we have an Indian village where authentic dwellings are. There's a Hopi dwelling, there's Havasupai sweat lodges, there's Navajo hogans, and we have greeters that take you through that area. We're continuing to upgrade that area. We're including a gift shop that is only selling authentic Native American arts and crafts, and we're also building a Ramada where they're going to demonstrate the making of what's being sold in that gift shop. We're also including a botanical garden of indigenous plants of the Hualapai and how they were used. And so you get to tour that, and also a performance of Native American dances, Hualapai, and other tribes. And then the Skywalk. You'll get the Skywalk at Eagle Point. And then you get to go to the western town and experience the Old West, and you can have an optional horseback ride. There is a petting zoo with a steer. His name is Norman. He thinks he's a dog, and we can't convince him he's not. And there's panning for gold. There's a performance there. You can get a horseback ride to the rim. So there's a whole array, and there's a wagon ride that's included in that package. So there's it for the cost of, it's basically $74.95.
Yeah, $75 is close enough.
Yeah, $75. You have a whole day of events if you can fit it all in.
Right.
And you can either get your meal at Guano Point or the Western Town. It's all you can eat. And the meal at the Western Town, it's a variety every day. The menu changes. Guano Point, it's the same meal every day. And we cook our beef traditionally in the ground. And it's taken out every morning and prepared our traditional way. So, but then we mess it up with barbecue sauce. It's delicious. I eat it every time I go out there. So to compare us to the South Rim in terms of prices is comparing apples and oranges.
This is really an adventure. It's an experience. And
yes.
You've actually answered the question. The best way to do this is to plan a whole day.
Mm-hmm.
Be sure to, you know, try to get out there
early.
In the a.m., you know, and then you get a ride. And plus, just driving over 14 miles of dirt road is an adventure all by itself. I've lived in the Southwest and lived off in remote areas, and I miss dirt roads. They're a great adventure. I don't think you should pave it. I think you should just leave it as it is. That could be part of the adventure.
And it's a Joshua Tree forest that you're going through.
Actually, you're offering it's a lot. It's
yeah.
a lot of opportunities to, and just the opportunity, for example, to experience the various cultures, the Native American cultures, as you say, is a very, very important part of this. That really does sound exciting. And by the way, can I get some fry bread?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Well, then I'm coming.
Yeah. Oh, well, and then, you know, our company also offers whitewater rafting. The only one-day whitewater rafting trips originate out of Peach Springs and pull out at Grand Canyon West.
Mm-hmm.
We have cabins at Grand Canyon West that you can stay overnight.
Oh, talk about that. I love cabins.
Yes, we have camping cabins at the Western Town. And we have, I believe we have 9 right now, but by the end of the year we'll have 40. And so, and they're getting booked fast. And they come as a package. They're also on the website. And they come as a package, and they include 3 meals and the spirit package. And people can add on the Skywalk or our Hummer tours, and I forgot to include, we also have helicopter boat tours where you can take a helicopter down to the bottom and land on the bottom and take a smooth water boat trip, which the South Rim does not have. You can't land on the bottom there.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm. I'm overwhelmed. That's a lot of, you've put a lot of effort into this. And
you're ready
and
to come, right?
I am. I'm not that far away. I'm going to give you a call.
Yeah, you need to come visit us.
I will definitely do that because I love the Southwest. If anybody has never experienced that, they absolutely must. And I think this really gives people an opportunity to experience it in a different way. And that would be really from the Native American perspective, the Hualapai tribe. Talk a little bit. Also share, because I think it's important for people as well. It's important for us to honor your legacy. Tell us what you can about the Hualapai and what is the spirit of the Hualapai that you wish to share?
We're a people that 150 years ago, we were hunters and gatherers. And I'm a member of the tribe. And we still have our language is still strong. And we're a proud people. We still make our baskets. We still put our babies in our cradle boards. All of my babies were in cradle boards. And we still try to hold on to our traditions, and we still honor our dead with our ceremonial funerals. We try to hold on to as much as we can, and there's a lot of pride in that. Even though there was so much that was tried to be taken away from us, I think we've overcome a lot of that. And even though there's still a lot of social problems, we try hard to hold on to our traditions and our culture, and it's a difficult task, but the pride is still there.
Well, I've had the great fortune of living amongst the Navajo and as well the Jicarilla Apache. To me, those are sacred memories for me. I want to wish you great success. You've really accomplished something. This just opened within the last couple of days.
Yeah.
Why don't we encourage people to contact the Grand Canyon Resort Corporation and make reservations?
The best way is to get on our website, destinationgrandcanyon.com, and that will get you to everything else. And to our, that will even get you to a number to speak to a live person.
That's great. Well, Sherry Yellowhawk, CEO of the Grand Canyon Resort Corporation, thank you so much for taking your time on this very busy day. I know that you've been extremely busy dealing with all of the events. I look forward to meeting with you and taking a walk on Skywalk.
Great. Thank you.
Another big story this week was the disappearance of a 12-year-old scout in North Carolina who was lost for 4 very long days. The story had a happy ending. The truth is, it can happen to almost anyone, and it can happen so fast. We all need to know what to do if we should ever find ourselves lost. A quick lesson in survival is coming up in the next 2 segments. Don't wander off. We'll be right back with more of the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Most of us live with a sense that it can't happen to us, that we are smart enough and savvy enough to keep our lives in order, and that's a good thing. But as we all know as well, sometimes things get skewed, sometimes they don't go as planned, and we find ourselves confronted with a realization that we now need to do the right thing to survive. I hope each of you has gotten far enough away into the wild and have had that moment when you feel, even if just for a split second, that you've lost your bearings. We take the next 2 segments to tell you what you need to know with a lesson in survival. Stay tuned. Oftentimes in the news, when we hear of a particular event that captures the attention of the nation and sometimes the world, it's a great time to use that as a moment for learning. And certainly the story of a young 12-year-old Boy Scout who was off with his family and friends in a church group in North Carolina in the mountains, and for various reasons wandered away and then was lost for 4 days. It's a great time to really think about what that means. He was very fortunate. He was found alive. But if it weren't for groups like Search and Rescue, which are scattered all around the country, there's a chance that he may not have made it back. The Search and Rescue provides terrific service at times like this of extremely dedicated people and their dogs and friends and associates. The Search and Rescue workers have saved many, many, probably thousands of lives throughout their history. Well, now joining us to talk about what Search and Rescue does, and also what people need to know if they find themselves in this situation, is Howard Paul, who is joining us now from Colorado. Howard, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you very much.
First of all, let's talk about the group that you're representing today, the National Association of Search and Rescue.
NASAR has been around since the 1970s, and it is, if you will, the professional association for people in the field. From across the nation and from other countries as well.
Mm-hmm. And how about a website so the people who want to may be able to follow along as you talk?
Certainly, that's www.nasar.org. Very simple.
Now, you're the president as well of the Colorado Search and Rescue Organization. How long have you been involved in Search and Rescue?
I became involved myself here in Colorado in Search and Rescue back in 1985. Seems like quite a long time ago.
What brought you to it?
It was interesting. I had been recruited to join a team and declined, didn't really see any interest in it. But a few years later decided to take that same team's training class in order to become a little more self-sufficient, be able to take care of myself when I was back skiing, hiking, that sort of thing. And it just sort of got in my blood and stuck.
Mm-hmm. Well, it does take a lot of training and coordination to effectively administer a search and rescue experience. What do people have to know before they head out on these challenges to locate someone who literally their lives are on the line?
Well, it's going to vary somewhat from region to region, and that typically would depend upon the weather and the topography. For example, the Adirondack Mountains will require different skills than the deserts of New Mexico, which require different skills than the high alpine peaks of Colorado or Washington. But typically, the person that does the best in search and rescue is someone that's very outdoors-oriented themselves. And that could just be from a recreational start, someone that's a hiker, a backpacker, a camper, a backcountry skier, or a climber, something along those lines. Most organizations have training programs of their own that they'll put you through. The National Association for Search and Rescue has training curricula that have been created by committee over the years and can lead to certifications that many teams or county sheriffs will use to ensure that all of their folks are properly trained.
Now, in your time working actually on search and rescue operations, how often are you called out?
That can vary greatly as well. There are some areas where a team might have 10 or 12 calls a year. There are others that might have more than 100 calls a year.
Wow.
And that depends greatly just upon the size of the community, the location. Are a lot of tourists drawn into that community during the summertime? Is it a big draw for winter recreationalists? Smaller rural or even frontier counties might be in that 10 to 12 category. If you're in an area that is extraordinarily popular for hikers or perhaps for technical climbers, such as Yosemite or the climbing areas outside Boulder, Colorado, you could be well up into the 100s a year.
Mm-hmm. And I think most of the people who are involved are doing this on a voluntary basis.
That's true. Most of the professionals providing that service, search and rescue across the nation, about 90% of them, are what we call unpaid professionals. They're giving of their time at no cost to anyone.
Well, it's an extraordinary service that you render. Let's talk about what are kind of the common ways in which people find themselves in need of your services.
Well, I think there are a couple of different things. One is perhaps just not quite paying attention as well as they should. And the second thing that's sort of related to that as well is even when you're paying attention, it is extremely easy to miss a trail junction or miss a trail sign. Literally, if you could be walking down a trail, approaching a trail junction, and something will distract you, perhaps the noise of an animal, even just a bird chirping off to one side. You look to the side as you're walking, and you've missed the trail junction because it's not very clear. You can't quite tell that you should have taken a switch back to the right. There's a little bit of a lesser trail leading straight on, and it's before you realize it, you're off the trail completely.
Well, and of course, if you're following some sort of topo map or some other map, it's extremely easy, as you say, to miss a fork because they may not be marked. And then all of a sudden you find yourself basically on the map somewhere, but you really have lost your orientation. And it's at a time like that, you may not know where you are on that map is where the trouble begins.
Mm-hmm. That's very true. It can be a sudden realization or it can be sort of a creeping realization that something doesn't seem right, or, you know, the stream I thought was going to be on my left, and now it's on the right. Something's wrong.
Right.
Either the land is wrong, the map is wrong, or I'm wrong.
Right.
Odds are I'm wrong, not the land wrong, or the map being wrong.
Unless you have some sort of GPS device and you know how to use it, that's where difficulties really begin. And
that's very true. Mm-hmm. And, you know, modern technology does a lot of things, but I caution everyone to not use modern technology as your as sort of your sole tool to get you through. Such things as GPS receivers and cell phones are notorious for failing at the wrong moment or not working out in the backcountry, especially cell phones.
That's a really good point, by the way.
If you're at high altitude, such as Colorado or California or anywhere where your terrain above most of the population, you may be in an area where your cell phone cannot tie into the cell phone system and you can't get a signal.
I hadn't even thought about that, really, but I think there's a lot of people that go out and say, well, that's okay, I've got my cell phone, but you're right.
Yeah.
By the time you think you need it, it's not there. You're
that's
in a
right.
dead zone.
And,
yeah.
And boy, panic can set in quickly if cell phone's not available.
You talked about not paying attention. Talk about that, because that's a really great point, too, that people oftentimes find themselves in these situations because they're not paying attention. What does that mean to pay attention?
Well, what does it mean to pay attention? Think ahead. Keep a map in your head of what your intended path is. It doesn't have to be specific. It can be general, as in I'm walking upstream, up this valley, and tending to climb to the left, which will put me on a ridge where I can see my destination. That destination might be a fire lookout tower. That destination might be a shelter hut along the trail, for example, on the Appalachian Trail. It could be a lake that I'm then going to descend to go fishing. Keeping that in mind, if things don't seem to match what you have in your head, that should be a pretty good clue that perhaps you and the lay of the land aren't quite matched up. When we talked about hiking on trails, obviously keeping an eye on a trail, and keeping in mind that trails sometimes for short distances will get overgrown or they might just peter out, you have to look ahead and see where that trail picks up again. The other thing, too, is just a general paying attention of your surroundings. And I'll give you an interesting but short story about one of the two times I was lost on a search mission. Now, I'll tell you, I wasn't lost for very long. The first time was for maybe 30 seconds. The second time was maybe for 5 minutes. But that first time, we had been on a search assignment. It was a team of three or four of us. We had been traversing a hillside all morning. Lunchtime came. We decided it was time to stop, take a break, have some lunch, put on some clean socks. And we all sat down and we were eating, and after just a few minutes, we decided it's time to get up and continue our assignment. We all stood up and we all looked around 360 degrees and had no idea which direction we had come from.
Wow.
And we're the trained searchers. Now, it didn't take long to figure it out. We quickly pinpointed ourselves on the map, and this was in the days before GPS, but using the map, using the compass, we could tell exactly where we were. But it was literally just that few minutes of not paying attention. We came in, we decided we're going to take a break, so we switched off our brains, we sat down, relaxed, and then when it was time, we stood up, we switched on our brains, and nothing matched up. So we, technically speaking, we were lost, but we found ourselves pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that simple.
I know one of the practices that I use all the time, it's some of the best advice I ever learned, I don't know who taught it to me, but that is when you're walking, frequently, turn around and look backwards. So that you see the lay of the land from the perspective that you're going to have to know it if you have to go backwards, as you have to go home, okay, or retrace your trail.
That's very, very true. Not only for folks that are hiking that haven't become lost, we teach that in search and rescue, that when we're searching for people, to constantly look behind you, look above, look to the left, look to the right. It's not unheard of that a searcher will have walked past someone or walked past a significant clue, which might be a hat that we have determined belongs to the person we're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very significant clue. We found their hat. They've got to be in this area. But if they had not turned back, they wouldn't have seen it, because approaching it because of the lay of the land, maybe some shading by trees, the direction of the sun, they wouldn't have seen it until they turned around when they were past it. And that really leads me to a good topic about how to not get lost, especially if you're a child like this 12-year-old scout.
Well, go ahead. Why don't we talk about that?
Certainly. there's a great national program called Hug a Tree and Survive, which is sponsored by the National Association for Search and Rescue, that we've been teaching since the late 1970s. It came out of Southern California after a boy went missing and was not found for several days, and was found, he had passed away. He had died, I believe, of hypothermia. And that shook quite a few of the people that were involved quite a bit. And it led to a gentleman named Ab Taylor, who was then a tracker with the Border Patrol, to help set up this program called Hug a Tree and Survive. And it teaches very simple core topics to young kids as young as kindergarten or even younger. It teaches kids to do things such as stay on the trail. It also teaches kids, as you just mentioned, to look behind and recognize a landmark. In the program, in the photographs, in the slides that we use, we show a young boy on the trail. We show him looking over his shoulder and seeing a big mountain that's plainly visible back up the trail, which he could use to return to the trailhead where the camper is if he had thought to turn around and look behind him.
It's amazing because there's two different worlds. It's the world you're going to and the world you're coming from, you just came from. And they're
right.
two totally different visions.
And two different visions, and most people are clued in, 99.9%, on the world you're going to.
Mm-hmm.
They don't think about the world you've come from. It's a great way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
The other things that that program teaches, and this is valuable for adults as well, although with kids, obviously, we use language that's keyed into them. Two things are of greatest importance. The number one is hug a tree. We teach kids to hug a tree specifically to keep them in one spot, to stop them from moving. It's much harder to find a moving target. The worst example could be this. Little boy, little girl gets lost. He hugs his tree for a while. Search teams are out looking. The little child decides to move on in hopes of finding someone, finding help. They don't even realize someone's looking for them, perhaps, other than their family. So they leave their tree and they move on. Guess what happens? After they leave their tree, the search team walks right past where that child had been. And the child has now walked into an area that has already been searched earlier that same day and might not be researched for 2 or 3 days. So that's why we want everyone, young child, even adults, stay put, let searchers come to you. And to help those searchers come to you, we want you, if you're lost, to do some things to attract them to you. For the little kids in Hug a Tree, we call that making yourself big. But the principles are the same with an adult. Make noise. You want to have bright colors. Obviously, if you're wearing a bright colored jacket or hat or gloves, they're going to be seen from a much greater distance than someone that's wearing blue jeans and a khaki shirt or an olive drab hat, which blends in nicely. One of the things that we teach every little kid is to carry a whistle around their neck, because it can carry, the sound carries so much farther, especially at night. And yes, we do search at night. Many people don't understand that we do. Search is an emergency. We've got to find someone before they have the opportunity to travel too far. So we do search at night. As a matter of fact, as far as my team is concerned, the majority of our searches start at night. We get that phone call for someone that hasn't returned at 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night. And we're out in the dark searching. There's an advantage that sound carries better in the dark. I don't know why, but it does. It's very advantageous.
Hmm. Maybe there's less ambient noise from creatures and different things. Maybe I'll have to give that some thought. That's fascinating. Here's a question. What you do is very much dependent on what you have with you. If you have nothing, I'd like to kind of approach this from two perspectives. One is if you find yourself lost and you have, let's say, a minimum of gear. You have maybe matches. You have or a lighter. You have some sort of protective clothing. Maybe you have a flashlight or something. So you have at least some protection. And the other would be if you find yourself with nothing, because there's, for example, if you have a tent, you could just hunker in and say, "I'm going to stay right here and until someone finds me," because eventually they will. Very likely they would. But if you don't have anything, then you have other concerns, which has to do with your own survival. Why don't you help us understand the differences there, or maybe there aren't that many differences.
Well, there are. I think the first thing to understand is once you realize you're lost, and whether that's that sudden realization or that creeping realization, there's an acronym, STOP, which stands for literally stop, think, observe, and plan. By following that acronym, it can sort of focus your mind, prevent panic from creeping in, which is the worst thing that can happen, because then you're going to make serious bad decisions that can complicate things. You've got to stop. You've got to think. Which way did I come from? Which way was the trail supposed to have gone? You've got to observe. Which way, you know, given the time of day, where's the sun? Which is going to give you an idea of which direction is which. You know, in the summertime at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, you know the sun's going to be over in the west to southwest side. After observing your situation, which includes where you are situated physically, you know, are you on a ridgetop, or are you on a valley floor, or are you next to flowing water, you've got to then plan. You've got to plan how you're going to take care of yourself for the next several hours, or perhaps a day or two. If you've got some minimal things with you, they're going to make your grand adventure a lot more, I suppose, comfortable is a good name. There's something that in Search and Rescue and in the mountaineering clubs, the Appalachian Mountain Club, the Colorado Mountain Club, the Mountaineers have talked about for many years, and it's called the 10 Essentials. And that's the 10 minimum things you should carry whenever you go into the backcountry. And that could be for a day hike, it could be for a one-hour mountain bike ride, it doesn't matter. Anytime you're away from immediate help, you want to have these things with you so that when you twist an ankle, whether hiking, whether you're on a mountain bike, whether you're skiing, but you're several miles in and you cannot get out because you can't walk, you've got to have these things to take care of you. And I'll run through them real quickly.
Sure.
Those 10 essentials are, obviously, perhaps not obviously, a first aid kit. That's something you really need to know how to use the stuff in it before the emergency hits. If you're in a semi-panic mindset, it's going to be very difficult to use that first aid kit. A map and a compass. And I'd say a map and a compass, and I include that in addition to perhaps a GPS that you might be carrying. Again, if you're in thick vegetation, the radio signal might not be able to penetrate. You may not be able to get a signal, especially if you've got one of the slightly older GPSs that do not have a map in it. All it gives you is a digital readout, perhaps an arrow for direction of travel. There's no map that you can follow on it. A pocket knife, that's a multi-purpose tool that can be used for lots of different things. Matches and a fire starter, waterproof matches and a fire starter. Fire starter could be something that you build from scratch, or it could be a little stick that you buy in a camping store that burns when you light it. Some sort of a impromptu shelter, and that can be something as simple as a very large garbage bag, or a tube tent, or a space blanket. A flashlight for when it gets dark, and it's going to get dark. Emergency clothing for both the temperature and rain. That's going to vary greatly in your climate. Here in Colorado, you don't have to worry about rain too much. As a matter of fact, we never get enough rain. But in the eastern part of the country, it's going to rain. In the desert southwest, it's not going to rain, but it's still going to get darn cold at night. So you've got to have some warm clothing. Include along with that some emergency food and some emergency water. When I'm teaching kids these 10 essentials, I tell them, emergency food is the stuff that's left over after you gobbled up everything you already wanted to eat during the day. So make it something that maybe isn't that great to taste. If your emergency food is nothing but Snickers bars, kids are going to eat them through the day. They'll have nothing left. Folks in search and rescue teams, they carry emergency food. Some of that stuff's been in their pack for a couple of years. They've got to be really hungry to eat something that's been in their pack drying out for 2 years. The last thing is really important at altitude when you're talking about snow, and that's sunglasses so that you don't get your eyes sunburned. And actually, there's an 11th essential that I learned from a sixth grader when I was teaching this class several years ago at an elementary school here in Evergreen, Colorado. And he said, the most important of the 10 essentials is a companion. And I kind of slapped my head and thought, boy, that's absolutely remarkably smart thinking. It's the old two heads are better than one. If I get in trouble, there's someone there to help me out. If you're not carrying the 10 essentials, you can still get through this situation. It's not going to be quite as comfortable. The important things are, again, you've got to stop, and you've got to stop early. Because you may have to find or build an impromptu shelter. And you want to do that before it's dark. Moving around in the dark in unfamiliar terrain, you may not be able to find or build shelter. And obviously, unless there's a pretty good moon, you may not be able to see where you're going. The least risk is sliding on a wet log and tripping an ankle. The worst risk is falling over the brink of something and injuring yourself. And I don't mean falling over a 1,000-foot cliff. I mean falling over maybe an 8-foot cliff.
If anybody's been out in the woods when it's pitch black, you cannot see anything. You can't see a stick 2 inches in front of your face. There's nothing. You're really extremely vulnerable. It's scary. It's a scary situation. I've been in those situations just kind of walking back after a hike through areas that I've been familiar with, but found myself in a pitch black night. And I'm telling you, that is a most unusual reality.
It really, really is. And there's nothing quite that dark, is there?
No, you literally feel your way every inch, you know. So the problem there is such an increased capacity for injuring yourself. And I know, for example, when I'm camping, I never like to put up after dark. Never. I always make every effort to be sure, even when I'm have my tents and my gear, to get in before dark and get that tent set up, because you just have so much greater opportunity to do it right.
Absolutely. When you're forced to make camp in the dark, you're always surprised in the morning at the spot you picked, aren't you?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, how in the world could I put this thing here? Yeah. We've covered some background and the 11 essentials, but there's more to this story. Next, we explore your options when you face the unknowns of being lost. As we continue this lesson in survival, when your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
A lesson in survival continues. What you need to do depends on what you have to do what needs to be done. What do you do if you find yourself lost with just the clothes on your back? Do you find yourself out of sync with your topo map as nightfall sets in? Are you geared up with provisions and gear? What you have to do has so many variables. Stop. Don't panic. Do the right thing. We'll be right back. We now continue with our lesson in survival with Howard Paul, president of Colorado Search and Rescue. Stick with us now, as the information you're about to hear may save your life. Well, no, this young boy was out there for 4 days. Apparently, he had wandered off on his own a little bit and got homesick. This is what I'm hearing now, and decided to hitchhike back to his town. That's what I couldn't figure out. How he's hitchhiking back to his town and his friends. Okay, and that's where he got into trouble. And then I've also just recently read that he did not follow your advice, and that is the fact that he kept wandering around. Talk about the importance of really making almost like a base camp. Isn't that really the best thing to do?
It really is. As long as someone knows where you are, you know, your general area. You've told someone where you're going. You've told someone when you're to be expected back. If you don't turn back up, someone's going to report you missing. Someone's going to be looking for you. So, again, it's important to help the searchers by remaining in either entirely stationary or in a very small area, again, so that you're not a moving target, which is hard to find, and you don't leave an area that's about to be searched and walk into an area that has already been searched. Now, again, with small kids, we talk about teaching them to hug a tree. A tree can be your friend. We, in searching for lost folks, use all sorts of different techniques. The obvious one is people on the ground, walking, listening, calling out, and looking for clues. The clues can be footprints, could be a piece of clothing, it could be a glint of color or a reflection off in the distance. These are all clues that are going to lead us to the lost person. We're actually not looking for the lost person. We're looking for the clues that lead us to the lost person.
Do you ever teach people to actually leave some sort of clue? Now, you don't do this if you're just hiking, because then you're destroying the natural environment, which you certainly don't want to do. But if you find yourself in a situation where you feel that you're lost, what are some ways that a person can actually leave those clues? What would you advise?
Well, I've seen folks that have actually written a note and left it on a trail with their name and some sort of message. I was involved in a search many years ago where a lost gentleman who was out racing us, he was moving so fast, he took the peel from his orange that he had eaten and with something had drawn an arrow on it on the inside of the orange and left it at a trail junction.
Great
with
idea.
His initials and said, "I'm going this way."
Great idea. Yeah.
When I talk about clues, I don't mean things that you necessarily specifically leave behind, but things that you might leave behind without realizing it. You know, people do drop wrappers from candy or granola bars. That's a great clue. But it may be something that you have inadvertently left. Could be a hat, could be a glove, something that's fallen off your pack. That's why when we interview the folks that have reported you missing, we do a very exhaustive interview as to what you're carrying, what are you likely to be carrying, what colors of clothing and equipment are you carrying, so if we come across something on the trail, we can quickly determine if that likely belonged to you or not.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, as I mentioned before, in assisting us to find you, even if you're going to hug your tree, whether you're a child or an adult staying in one area, it's best if you can pick a tree or pick a spot to remain in that's near a clearing, so that if you hear an aircraft, especially a helicopter, you can go out into that clearing and you'll be much easier to see. When we teach the kids this concept, we teach them to go out into the clearing and lay down almost like they're making snow angels, because they're a bigger target to see from the air than if they were standing up and all we can see is their head and their shoulders. That gets back to making yourself big. You know, the other thing is, if you've got objects of color, and that could be, you know, almost anything. It could be a piece of paper, a piece of fabric, a wrapper from food. If you can hang those in a tree, in a circle around your general area, and within, you know, distance that you can see easily. Again, those are out of the ordinary objects that are going to catch the eye of a searcher. They're not going to catch the eye of someone in a helicopter because they're too high and they're moving too fast. They're essentially looking for spots of color. But a searcher on the ground, something in a tree is extraordinarily unusual, unnatural, and they're going to catch that in their eye and investigate it immediately.
Now, in this particular case with the boy in North Carolina, this apparently is a fairly common thing, and we'll talk a little bit about hypothermia, because that is a very serious problem. But when he was discovered, and I'd also like you to touch on the role of search and rescue dogs and how we can help them find you, they were calling out and he didn't respond. which if for some, you know more about that than I do, but that seems to be somewhat of a common experience.
Well, that's true. There are a couple of reasons that a youngster might not respond. You mentioned hypothermia for one. Hypothermia, by definition, is your body is losing heat faster than it can create heat. And that can be caused by it's either extremely cold and wet, or on the other side of that equation, your body has run out of fuel and it can no longer create heat by shivering, for example, because your reserves of sugar are so low. So it's either you have not enough fuel to warm up, or you can't make up the heat that you've already lost because of the outdoors, the surroundings around you. And cold is exacerbated. It's made so much worse by moisture. One of the worst things you can get caught in when it starts to rain are jeans or anything else that's cotton. We call it, in search and rescue for years, we've been talking about killer cotton, because when it gets wet, it just sucks the heat and energy right out of you. You cannot reproduce that heat fast enough. When the body starts to cool down because of hypothermia, and by the way, very vigorous shivering is not necessarily a sign of extreme danger. That's your body using its fuel to try and reheat itself back up. It's a very good warning sign that you probably need some help in warming back up, but it's not a sign of terrible danger. But when the body starts to cool down, several things happen. And essentially, the problem is that the brain is not functioning as it normally would. So it will not correctly control involuntary actions and even voluntary actions. Obvious sign is when someone starts to lose muscle coordination. And that can be something as simple as stumbling, not being able to walk as well as you normally would, maybe having difficulty in putting on mittens or gloves. You're losing that muscle coordination. The next thing is that you might start to have difficulty speaking. You might slur words. That's another sign. There are three stages of hypothermia. We're talking now about getting into that moderate stage of hypothermia that really requires help from someone else, and that is in rewarming you and keeping you warm by putting on additional clothing. Rewarming you maybe by building a fire, giving you some additional fuel that you can burn to get that furnace going again and reheat from the inside, and put on some extra warm and dry clothing. This time of the year is actually sometimes even considered worse than winter time for hypothermia, and summer can be as well. And most folks might be surprised by that. There's a reason why. People are prepared generally in the wintertime for cold weather. So they take that stuff along that they need. They take that extra clothing. In the spring and in the summer, they're not thinking cold, so they're more likely to be caught without the extra clothing when the wind kicks up and the rain starts, and suddenly now they're soaking wet, and they're in a 10 or 15 mile an hour breeze, and that convection cooling is just, it's sucking the heat out of you faster than you can replace it.
I'm getting uncomfortable thinking about that. I've been in those situations. And one of the things about hypothermia is the fact that it can come on so quickly that, you don't even know what's happening. It doesn't take long to get, before you find yourself chilled, you get a little wet, as you say, possibly even from just perspiration. And then a cold or a cool breeze comes in, and the next thing you know, you're starting to go into that zone. It doesn't take long to get there, does it?
No, it doesn't take long at all. And the important thing to remember is when you go from that first stage hypothermia, which you'll recognize you're cold, but you probably aren't thinking hypothermia. When you go from that first minimum stage into that moderate stage, you're now having enough, your brain has decreased in its ability enough that you will not recognize it in yourself. And that's why we always tell people when you're in a group to keep an eye on each other, because they will recognize in you where you won't. They'll see that you're having muscle coordination problems. You're stumbling. You're having difficulty putting on mittens. You perhaps are having difficulty getting up after taking a lunch break.
It's odd. I was out cross-country skiing with a couple of friends, a guy and his girlfriend, and we got a little out ahead of her or something to that effect, and she just seemed to disappear. And so at some point we thought, well, what's going on here? And we went back, and she was actually on the ground, and she said, well, listen, I'm just taking a little rest here. Why don't you guys go on without me? Well, obviously she was in that mid-stage there.
Yep.
She seemed sort of normal, except that it didn't make any sense. But this was just within about 15 or 20 minutes. And she was completely irrational in terms of how she was thinking. You guys go on, I'll catch up with you, which was ridiculous. She was on the ground in the snow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If that's not a clue, nothing is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we talked about the Boy Scout that was missing, and they did mention hypothermia. I'm not sure what the weather was back there, but it certainly was cool at night. That's why it's so important to find or improvise some kind of shelter. You want to be out of the wind. If there's any chance of moisture, rain, sleet, a quick hailstorm like we get here in the Rockies, it could only last 10 or 15 minutes, but it could be a real heavy storm that can just drench you. You want to be out of the rain, out of the wind. That means finding a shelter, which could be something as simple maybe as a rock outcrop that's going to protect you from above and from the wind. Or if you can't find something, you're going to have to improvise something, perhaps in the form of a lean-to or something like that.
Now, here's a question. I've run across situations where people have managed to survive. You've done that many more times than I have. But where they're out, for example, in cold weather with a minimum of gear and no real protective clothing, and yet they manage for 2 or 3 days in very cold situations. How are they doing that? What's the best way, if you find yourself in that situation, how can you literally protect yourself against that cold if you're not prepared? And you can't do a fire, you know, but what in your environment have you found or have you heard from people who have managed to survive works?
Well, if you don't have any of those 10 essentials, you're literally unprepared. It's going to be extremely difficult. The two things that you can do, again, are shelter and create heat by exercise. You've got to be able to keep that body warm, and the only way you can do that without anything else is you've got to be able to create that heat internally. That could be as simple as walking uphill. The problem, of course, now is that you're using fuel, which is limited, and at some point in time you're going to run out of fuel. Now, if the weather is good, it's not windy, which that convection cooling is going to cool you off. It's not wet. That's helpful. You can probably rewarm in the sunshine. That's if it's not a cloudy day like it is here in Denver today.
Let's talk about that night when you got to go those long, 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 endless, cold, miserable, torturous nights that you have to endure. What's the best way to survive those?
Well, you know, I've talked to folks and have heard stories from others that have survived those long, long, cold nights. Every single one of them seems to say the same thing. They just try and catch some sleep, and that they'll get sleep in small chunks. Now, when you get sleep in small chunks, that's what makes that night seem like it's the longest night there ever has been on the planet. Those chunks are probably going to be it might be 20 minutes of sleep here, 30 minutes there, and then you're going to wake up, and you're maybe going to shiver. Maybe some exercise. It's time now for exercise to rewarm yourself, and then try and get some sleep some more. And then I think the rest of it is what I would call mental gymnastics, is putting yourself in the right frame of mind and orienting your mindset towards survival, looking ahead to the morning as opposed to concentrating on your situation now, or what got you into the situation, looking forward is probably of a great benefit.
I've spent some of those situations where I've had an absolutely miserable night, and there's nothing like that first crack of dawn.
That's true.
Oh, you feel a new day coming on, and there's hope again.
That's very, very true. Sometimes those great camping trips can be miserable.
Yes, absolutely. Well, listen, and then one last thing. We could go on for, this is great, and I think it's very valuable, but also the role of the search and rescue dogs. In this particular case, the dog picked up the scent, and it didn't take that dog all that long to find this lost boy in North Carolina. What can you tell us about how to help the search and rescue dogs? Are there ways to help them as well as the teams find you?
There are. The most important thing when it comes to making it easier for a SAR dog, a search dog, to find you is if that dog and that dog's handler, they work together as a team, can have what we call a scent article. You know, a search dog, any dog's ability to smell is in the thousands of times more than us poor little humans. If there is a scent article, something that they can get your specific scent off of, they can then discriminate that scent from that of other people.
It's amazing.
A great scent article is something like a sock that's going to be saturated with scent. Any other piece of clothing is going to work well as well. It doesn't even have to be a piece of clothing. I've seen dogs where the handler has taken them to the missing person's car and scented them, gotten the dog to sniff the car seat, the floor, anywhere where scent will settle. Scent is actually very tiny cells that are constantly falling off your body and leaving this invisible trail behind. So a dog can pick up that scent off clothing, can pick it up off the car seat, it can pick it up off the ground around a car. For example, at the back of a car where someone might sit on a bumper to put on their boots or to grab their day pack before they head off. So if the dog handler has a scent article, it's going to speed things up. Now, without a scent article, dogs are still useful. They can still find human beings in a given area, but they might find other human beings there as well. So how the dogs are used depends on whether they have a scent article or not, who has been in the area previously, and that sort of thing. Dogs can find scent from a great distance away. It all depends entirely upon the weather in that sense. Which way is the wind blowing? How warm or cool is it? Is it wet or is it dry? I mentioned that the scent the dog is looking for are tiny cells that are constantly falling off of your skin. If the weather is warm and breezy, this isn't too hard to imagine, it's going to dry those cells out, and those cells are going to lose their scent. They're essentially going to die.
Mm-hmm.
If it's cool and slightly damp, that's going to keep the scent in those cells going longer. And if there's a slight breeze to kind of stir them up into the air, that's going to improve that dog's ability to catch that scent even more.
Is there such a thing as leaving scent trails, like rubbing the back of your neck or other places that may be sort of sweaty or whatever, and rubbing them on rocks or that type of thing? Might that be useful to kind of make these scent trails, if you were thinking, you know, to try to leave your own scent trail, might that be useful, do you think?
You know, it makes sense to me.
And then for those people who have a fire, that really is an advantage, isn't it? Because you can actually, you have heat and other things, but what would be a way to help people locate that fire?
Well, if you're talking about daylight, obviously it's got to be smoke.
Mm-hmm.
At night, the fire itself, of course, and making sure that the fire doesn't get so large that it can get out of hand and start a forest fire. I had a youngster ask me once if we go in and fight forest fires, and I said, no, we're search and rescue.
Mm-hmm.
We go in when people are lost. If there's a forest fire, we run the other way with everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
But the way to use that fire to attract people during the day is to create smoke. Create smoke by putting wet vegetation on it, letting that thing billow up some smoke, it's going to do one of two things. Someone's going to see it and say, there's smoke over there, we need to go investigate it, see if that might be a clue leading us to our lost person who's standing by the fire. The other thing that could happen is someone's going to see that smoke and they're going to report it to the authorities, who more than likely are going to call in the fire department to go in and investigate, thinking that we might have a wildfire going. And again, you've got people coming in to help, there's a great chance they're going to find you.
This is such a fascinating topic, and I certainly want to encourage anyone who finds this at all interesting to contact your organization. We're talking with Howard Paul, who is with NASAR.
The National Association for Search and Rescue, and the web address is nasar.org, nasar.org.
How long does it take to get certified?
Classes are that are conducted by SAR teams can run anywhere from a few short weeks to many weeks. The NASAR type of curriculum can, again, be a few short weeks or a several weeks long. It depends upon the way that the SAR teams use it. My particular SAR team here in Colorado does a training class one night a week for about 8 or 9 weeks, and then follows that up with 3 or 4 full-day sessions out in the field on weekends. So you're talking a total of about one night a week for 12 weeks with 3 or 4 weekend days thrown in there as well. There are other teams that will do it in a more compact manner. There are other teams that will stretch it out over an entire year, sort of on-the-job training.
Well, I can't think of a better way, really. If you like the outdoors, and you have to like the outdoors to be involved in this, rather than just go on hikes, maybe get involved with a SAR team training unit, and benefit yourself and as well those around you. Howard Paul, I want to thank you so much for giving all this terrific information, and I wish you great success in all the future endeavors. Thanks so much.
It's been my pleasure, sir. Thanks very much.
You bet. Thanks for coming along on this week's adventures into the realms of nature and the environment as we journey through the backwoods and the byways to live in harmony with the great gift, this earth, and all the mysteries it provides. Next week, we go deep into the minds of the wild creatures as we look at the emotional lives of animals with Dr. Mark Beckhoff. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet next Thursday or any time on the archives when your Voice of the Earth returns on the Wild Side News.